Good morning and welcome back to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. We're pleased to have you listening this morning as we continue with the show. In this hour of our program, we'll be talking with the journalist and media critic Ben Bagdikian. He is Dean Emeritus of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. And before that, was a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, editor, and ombudsman at the Washington Post. He's the author of a book that has become something of a classic in the communications field. The title of the book is The Media Monopoly. It was first published in 1983, and it outlined his concern that a small number of corporations controlled most of the country's media. At that time, he wrote, 50 corporations own most of the output of daily newspapers and most of the sales and audience in magazines, broadcasting, books, and movies. Today, that number has shrunk from around 50 to about 10. And in the fifth edition of his book, which was published this past spring, he writes, in the preface to the new edition, he writes, in the last 5 years, a small number of the country's largest industrial corporations has acquired more public communications power, including ownership of the news, than any private businesses have ever before possessed in world history. Nothing in earlier history matches this corporate group's power to penetrate the social landscape, using both old and new technology by owning each other's shares, engaging in joint ventures as partners, and other forms of cooperation. This handful of giants has created what is, in effect, a new communications cartel within the United States. The Media Monopoly, the fifth edition of the book, is available in a paperback published by Beacon Press out of Boston. So if you're interested in reading it, you certainly can look for it. Our guest is also the author of another book that is an autobiography that was published fairly recently and certainly should still be available in bookstores and at the library if you'd like to read it. That book titled Double Vision, Reflections on My Heritage, Life, and Profession. That was also published by the Beacon Press, so that's another opportunity for you to read some of his writing. And as we talk this morning, you are welcome to call in. Maybe you will have questions, comments. All we ask is that people be brief, simply to include as many different callers as possible and kind of keep things moving along. But everyone's welcome into this conversation, and it's easy to do. All you need to do is call us. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And if you match the numbers with letters on the phone, you get WILL. So it's 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Bagdikian, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, I'm happy to.
And when the book was first published in 1983, I think some people said your concern was unwarranted, maybe it was overstated. It certainly seems as if your concern has been borne out over the years as this concentration that you wrote about at that time has continued.
Well, frankly, I had been working on this book back in the late 70s and the early 80s, and just had to get it out of my system. I had worked in the newspaper business most of my adult life and knew, because I worked for a couple of them, that the best newspapers, the best news operations were run by family-owned groups or small groups. Now, some very bad papers were run by family also, but all of the distinguished ones were run by people who had the power to say, we're making enough profit and we take the news seriously and we will be careful to preserve the special quality that news has in society. And I saw this changing as the news became part of the national, international financial scene and as just another business. And I spent 3 or 4 years working on it, got it published with some difficulty. My former big publisher said they couldn't really handle it. And I figured then, it's out of my system. I'll go back to doing other things. And you're quite right. Some people said it was alarmist, that this is the way it always was, and nothing as much has changed. And then I was almost forced to do subsequent editions because conditions became much worse than I thought they were at the time I did the first edition. So that's quite right. Mm. I was surprised and saddened by how each edition I put out understated the problem. Mm.
Do you think that this trend of the increasing concentration and the shrinkage of the number of corporations that have a great deal of control over media will continue to the point where in a year or two more we might be talking about, instead of 10, 4 or 3?
Well, I think there's a limit to how far down it can go for some reasons that are strictly business reasons. But I don't think it's going to change in terms of major operations anytime soon. And it'll take time for the way the public feels, or a large part of the public, to make a difference, because public cynicism toward the news has never been higher. And I think that what's happening now will increase that cynicism, and especially among Americans who take their news very seriously. So they're cynical about it. They turn to other kinds of looking around, to alternatives, to public non-commercial operations. And so I think that there will be an erosion of the importance of news when it's run as a commercial product, but that will take time. Mm. In the meantime, the public cynicism, I think, is very dangerous, because a cynical public that doesn't totally trust the information it's getting is open to rumor, paranoia, and so forth.
Since the 80s, on and off to a greater or lesser degree, there has in government been this idea that less regulation is better. And the trends that we see in media certainly are, at least in part, a result of deregulation. People in government have made the argument all along, and as recently as last year when they talked about the Communications Act that was passed, made this argument that deregulation leads to greater competition, which is good for consumers. It means they will have more choice, not less. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, I think that what's wrong is that, of course, one should deregulate those activities that, number one, have really disappeared in any significance. We don't regulate the making of horse-drawn buggies anymore. And also, there are some that are just red tape. But I think it is either ignorance or cynical of those who say we should go through massive deregulation, because many of those same people or companies insist on regulations that help them. For example, the government regulates the licenses for through the air broadcasters. And the broadcasters insist on being regulated because that regulation says if somebody is broadcasting on a frequency, anyone who intrudes on that frequency, the so-called pirate stations, without a license, can go to prison and be fined. And the broadcasting industry insists on that, and they insist on it for a very good reason, that any talented high school boy can make a broadcasting station in his father's garage. And if that happened, and it's happening with some pirate stations, which are operated out of vans and automobiles, you begin having jamming and makes for chaos in the airwaves. So you have to look at this demand for deregulation to see who wins and who loses. And the problem with that, with what's happening now, is that the argument is whether Corporation A wins or Corporation B wins, and very seldom do spokespeople for the consumer play an important part on what is regulated and deregulated.
Our guest this morning is journalist and media critic Ben Bagdikian. He is Dean Emeritus of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. Before that, spent a number of years working as a reporter and worked at the Washington Post before going to teach at Berkeley. He is the author of a book that we have mentioned here. It was first published in 1983 and has been published in a series of editions since. The one that's out now is the fifth edition that's been published with a new preface by the Beacon Press. And the title of the book is The Media Monopoly. And questions, of course, questions, comments are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. What do you think are the consequences of this concentration of ownership for the public, for the consumers of news in this country?
Well, I think the public is getting more and more trivial and less central issue news, because so many of the companies that now, the large industrial companies that own the news operations, the major news operations in the country, for example, are traded on Wall Street. Wall Street wants ever-rising earnings every 4 months, quarterly earnings. They're under tremendous pressure to increase the value of their stock, to pay better dividends, even though the newspaper business, for example, daily newspaper business, Standard & Poor's says they make more than 20% profit a year, and broadcasters make even more, commercial broadcasters. But Wall Street always wants more, and so if you're a very large corporation that makes airplanes, electrical generators, so forth and so on, but also owns a news company, a major news company, you see that as a product that has to contribute increasing profits, and what do? You shift the news to things which are not going to rock the boat. Local TV news, commercial TV news, for example, is kind of a national disgrace. It's superficial. It's mostly visiting the police station and the emergency rooms every night. Very little coverage of what's going on in the city government and the school system and so forth. So we see the trivialization of news. We see news is mixed with entertainment, and we see news in mixed with advertising. And this dilutes and corrupts the news in ways that are subtle and gradually gets a large part of the public used to the fact that news is going to be given by someone with a nice hairdo and a projecting personality, and doesn't make much difference what they talk about. And that leads to a false assumption by much of the public that they know the most important things that are happening that will affect their lives, and they don't.
Mm. Is the concern further than simply that the content of the news is bland, it's not dealing with important issues? Is the concern that that companies who have ownership of newspapers or radio stations or cable networks or whatever, and also are in other businesses as well, will make sure that the journalists who work for them don't do any stories that will reflect negatively on the other businesses in which they're involved?
Oh, that's happening, and it's happening what used to happen subtly in the business, always, which is in papers that didn't have an unusually strong owner that felt that the integrity of the news was important. It was done subtly. If you did a story that showed that the used car dealers in this community had bad record with the regulating agencies, they'd say, well, you know, this really isn't a terribly important story. But now it is wide open. The Los Angeles Times, which may by now be the biggest circulated daily paper in the country of general news, has openly said that there will be co-managers of the news. One will be from the business department and one will be an editor. And that some of the sections of the paper will be run by the business department. And it is the most bold move. I'm sure it'll be followed by other bold moves to adjust the news in order to not make advertisers unhappy and to attract advertising and not to disturb the business community. And I think it's a very ominous development, and I don't think it's going to get better for a while.
Mm. Is it is the notion of good journalism, and is that incompatible with the idea of turning a profit with whatever kind of news organization you've got going?
Well, I did a study once of the papers that have survived a very long time and those that died along the way. And it was overwhelming. It wasn't absolutely 100%, but I would guess it was something in the order of 85-90%. the papers that had the reputation for having the most solid news lasted the longest. And you can see that in the papers, that to say the New York Times has survived over under the present ownership for over 100 years, the Washington Post for well over 50 years, and all the competitors, most of their competitors have fallen by the wayside because they played fast and loose with the news and didn't take the public seriously. So I think, yes, good journalism does pay off, but it pays off in the long run, and that's the problem. If you say, well, you've got to show results in 3 months with more profits, you can't do that with the news. It's one of those things that's fundamental in people's daily habit and how they grow up, and you don't change family patterns that quickly. But history shows that by far the better papers survive when they had better news, and the weaker ones that were sensationalist or trivializing the news fell by the wayside.
Well, I suppose we have seen many cases where when news entities, organizations, whether they be papers, magazines, publishers, television networks, have been acquired, the people buying them have paid a lot of money for them, and then they have said, now I expect you to make money for me. Profit-making probably has the kinds of patterns of acquisitions that we have seen has made profit-making more of a priority than it has been in the past.
That's right, and it's part of the dilemma in all of journalism, because most journalism is going to be a private enterprise, a business enterprise, and most of it has to be, because the biggest alternative is government, and we know government control of news has produced very bad results in history. Now, I think so that inevitably most of it is going to be a business. Now, I think there should be a much larger non-commercial news and TV radio operation than we have in the United States. We should do more like the BBC in England and NHK in Japan and most of the Western European democracies, which have much more substantial non-commercial news operations than we have. But nevertheless, even there, the majority of the news is a private business, and will undoubtedly stay that way. And then that raises the dilemma. If it is a private business, you treat the news as just another business, and that's the problem. If you have concern with the public good, you run the business as a good business, as an efficient and intelligently run business, but it is not just another business like making shoelaces or snowplows. You've got to treat it as something which is a business, but one that socializes every generation and lies at the heart of democracy. You've got to inform people about what's happening in their country and in their community so they can vote with information. And that's the dilemma. Can a business be trusted to do it? Some businesses can, and some businesses can't. And the bigger you get as a business, the less important news is as part of the whole.
We have a couple of callers here. Others who are listening would be welcome to join the conversation. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free. Anywhere you can hear us, you may use the toll-free number. That's 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here to start. And the first one is in Chicago, and it's line 4. Hello.
Hi. I was reading some of your articles when you were still reporting for the Providence Journal.
You have a long memory.
Yeah, and of course, book reviews of your books, and I want to thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Yesterday, there was a guy on this program who was head of CNN, I guess, and I asked a couple of questions from him, and essentially was told that the sources of my information were full of baloney. And I want to repeat these questions and see what you have to say about them. First point was that an executive of one of the networks, who was no longer executive, made a statement that that. 7 or so years ago, when the networks were being bought up and were cutting their staffs in half, he made the statement that CNN had been reported to be doing an excellent job during the Gulf War, while the networks hadn't. But ever since then, it was doing a poor job. And my question was, what do you think of that? And of course, he disagreed. The second question was related to a program, a discussion program on CNN, where they had two conservatives and two purported liberals opposing each other on various questions. And he disagreed with the characterization that the purported liberals were purported liberals. And I was wondering what you thought of both of these answers.
Well, on your first question, I think that the cutback by the new corporations that bought the networks has been very harmful. We are the remaining superpower in the world. We hear constantly that we are for trade and for diplomacy and so forth. The United States must have a role in every part of the globe, because sooner or later what happens in the rest of the globe affects us. But what do we hear when we turn to the networks for our foreign news, for example? We hear BBC reporters or reporters for other European countries, English-speaking countries, being our reporters. Now, there's nothing, some of them are splendid, but they don't know the United States intimately. They are simply people selected to repeat very brief news. And an American child could grow up thinking that when you discuss foreign affairs in this country, you use British English. But when you call it domestic affairs, you can talk American English. But the real problem is that if you don't have a foreign bureau, your person, an American who understands American society and its needs, will not have depth of knowledge of that country. And therefore, you may be a very large organization, but that organization begins to lose its expertise in that area of the world. And we have now almost denuded ourselves of broadcast bureaus in very important parts of the world. They have a few, but you're quite right. They closed down most of the foreign bureaus in the 80s when the big companies took over, other companies took over. And we suffer for it. So that's, I think that on foreign news, certainly, the big networks do very badly in terms of their inherent ability to understand what's going on in that country. And then, and because a person on their own bureau can alert them to things that are coming up that's important, whereas an outsider gets paid only for what the time they put in the air, doesn't do that. Secondly, on the discussions between so-called conservatives and liberals, most of those programs, not all, but most of them, the ones that get the biggest publicity, are ones which are not intelligent discussions at all, but shouting matches, because that's entertainment. They're combat discussions. And also they have another problem with me. I talk to a lot at universities, and hear a lot of arguments pro and con from progressive liberals versus conservatives. And I think that commercial operation discussions are, and sometimes on even public television, between so-called conservatives and liberals, whatever that may mean in this new mix of things we have in current politics, is frequently someone that is very conservative versus someone who is a rather mild liberal, and does not represent progressive thinking in the same sense that the conservative represents rather hard conservative thinking. So I don't think we hear a really balanced view very often when you get these so-called two-side discussions on the air.
Thank you. One more question. I don't know whether it's me or someone, I believe that the New York Times has become more commercial in recent years, and it's not as good a paper as it was, say, 20 years ago. Do you have any opinion on that?
Well, I think two things have happened at the Times. It still has a great deal of news in some depth, which is important, and which remains probably the most commonly available source of that. in the printed daily news. But it also, I think, in an attempt to make it more readable and to get out of what its reputation had been in the past, which is, well, it's pretty solid paper, but they all sound like the beginning of PhD dissertations. Very turgid and difficult language in the stories. They've become much more contemporaneous. And in the process, I think they have also introduced things which are not simply well-written. They're much better written than they used to be, but are also entertainingly written. And when that begins to get into the more serious news, we all want some entertainment in our lives, but when it gets into serious news, I think that does dilute it sometimes. So I think it's a mixture of those things, and some of that, of what you described, is valid.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Well, Professor Bagdikian, what do you think is the best paper or the best couple of papers today?
Well, I've always tried not to get into that, and for this reason. I see a lot of papers when I travel, but there are 1,500 daily papers. And no sane person has read them all long enough to have a picture of how they all perform. I think that there are some very good small papers. Every now and then I get into a town, a city, and I see a paper that they really cover their community. They really select the national news from the networks, from the wire services very intelligently. Most of what I see is very depressing in that regard. But I don't see them all, and I think it takes a very systematic study. I've done that in the past, and it was possible to come up with a better papers, but most of those have changed hands and their nature, so that you have to be very careful when you say this is the best paper or these are the three or four best papers. You can say there are three or four very good papers in some regards, and they have weaknesses in other regards. So I've stayed out of the 10 best game throughout most of my career in doing analysis and criticism.
And we have several callers here. We'll start right in again with a caller in Champaign on line one.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm afraid that actually David's already asked my question, but I want to sort of press once again for some advice from you as to how to go about locating alternative sources of information. If you don't want to give the 10 best newspapers, I can understand that. But is there anything that you can give me in the way of concrete advice to find a different source of information, whether it's online, whether there are publications that are issued monthly? I want to make a slight comment, and that is that, you know, mainly through this program, have heard different people come on and talk about this very issue. There's somebody who comes on once in a while and talks about the top 10 censored stories that are covered in the alternative media, but not in the big ones that I think you attempt to criticize. And so I go back and I look at those, and I'm kind of thinking, gee, a lot of this sounds anecdotal to me, and I don't know how much of it is substantiated. And so I kind of feel like I can sympathize with your point, and it is disturbing to me that there is this kind of monopoly. That, you know, power seems to be consolidated within the hands of these few corporations. On the other hand, I feel pretty unclear about where I'm to turn in order to find other sources of information. I think you mentioned that it's a pretty difficult kind of thing. I mean, it takes a great deal of analysis and scrutiny. And, you know, for a person like me who doesn't really have that kind of time, frankly, I wonder what your suggestions are is to get a clearer view, or do you think that a clearer view can really be gotten?
Well, I don't think there's a simple answer to your question, which is, and I understand you want a simple answer because a vague one isn't very practical. I find it useful to look at, and I'm talking now about nationally published material. Locally, one has to judge by one's own, you know, weekly papers and alternative papers, and they vary enormously. Many of them are extremely useful. And so in each city, I would look at those, and some of them are free. And so when you go pick up some of them and look at them and see if they inform you about the things you're most interested in. Nationally, I find it useful to look at the publications that are, in fact, publications of commentary. which then comment if they're, and most of them are useful in the sense that they comment on issues that they care about, and which are frequently issues that you don't see dealt with in any seriousness in the major media. If you're a conservative and you're unhappy, look at the National Review regularly. If you think that the news that you're getting is too shallow on the center or on the liberal progressive side, look at the Nation, the New Republic, the Progressive in these times. They're very useful in raising issues and events that may strike you in your interests as very important, and begin to give you an idea of where to look for specialized or more concentrated information on those subjects. On the Internet, yes, you can get an enormous amount, but it's chaotic. You have to do spend a lot of time searching to find the sites that provide you with the information you want. And I think that requires not only enormous skill, but a lot of time to find the sites that are giving you what you want. So I find it easier to begin with a printed commentary, including with commentary I don't agree with, to see issues that, in fact, are very important that I hadn't seen much about in the standard media or heard it in the standard media. And that gives you a clue. But I think it takes work, and that's what I regret. That's why I think that the standard news is so terribly important to fight for the integrity of the standard news, because that's what most people are going to get no matter what. And that's what most voters are going to get. But for the individual who is consciously unhappy with what they get, the easiest way is to get these magazines of commentary. Go to a place that has lots of magazines and look at them and see which ones touch your particular interest, because not everybody's interested in the same, not every issue means the same thing to every person. So that's what I would do. I can't go much beyond that. But if you find a daily paper that gives you some substance, read it every day. Because somewhere in there, sooner or later, you'll see something mentioned. Or you may see major things periodically, but not often enough. And then you go to these other sources.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We'll go to another caller here. They're on the campus. It's line 2. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Wanted to comment on your comment about the talk shows. But, the liberals are usually lukewarm liberals. I think you're exactly right, except you might say that they were moderate conservatives usually. That is, the pseudo-liberals on these discussion programs.
Well, you say you think that what you usually get is a moderate conservative and a pseudo-liberal.
No, an extreme conservative and a moderate conservative.
No, I think you're right.
Masquerading as a liberal.
Well, I think that's right.
And
I think that is exactly right, and that's what most of them are. Either that, or they're simply getting people who shout well.
Yes. Occasionally you do get a moderate liberal, but you never get anyone from the real left, not the liberal left, but the real left, something like Michael Harrington.
Yeah, well, that's what I think the problem is today in the labels, because liberal is now much more like the meaning of liberal in Europe, which is a center and even conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And today the issues have changed, and the nomenclature doesn't mean as much. So I think you're right that you have to get people whose substance shows that they are bringing up issues which are important, and I agree. I think people comparable to Michael Harrington would be the proper counter to the usual conservative that appears in those shows.
Well, I greatly enjoy it.
I think what's
it.
Happened as a result of the treatment of the media of such issues and such ideas is that the spectrum of American politics has shifted so much to the right, with its high point, of course, in the 94 election, that what used to be thought of as extreme conservative and almost negligibly important conservative is almost in the center. And that what used to be considered the progressive left has been pushed off the spectrum.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left with our guest, Ben Bagdikian. He's the Dean Emeritus of the Graduate School of Journalism at University of California, Berkeley. And we're talking about the issue of concentration of ownership in media. And this is something that he writes about in his book, The Media Monopoly, which was first published in 83 and has appeared in a series of updated editions. The one that's out now is the fifth, just published this past spring with a new preface by the author. And it's certainly should be available if you want to look at it. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL.
David, let me add one thing, if I may. There's
yes.
a new afterword also,
oh,
which I give some of the ideas, I think, underlie the facts.
Indeed.
But thank you. That's what you say is correct.
Some of the kinds of acquisitions that have created this concentration that we've talked about happen, there is the opportunity for a review on the basis of antitrust and for questions to be raised about whether we think that kind of ownership across media is a good thing. Have we been lax in, has the government been lax in this review and allowing mergers and acquisitions to go forth that in the past we might have said we don't think are in the interest of the American people?
Yes, I think terribly so. I think the Department of Justice has almost put to sleep antitrust actions, which 30, 40 years ago would have been almost automatic because the measure used then is not the measure used now. And so that I think, yes, antitrust does need to be used, and especially with media corporations, because you're dealing with what is a social product, not just a manufactured product. And the FCC has reversed its standards also. The FCC used to ask each applicant for a license. What do you plan to do for the communities in your broadcast area if you get this license? And then when renewal time came, and they didn't tell them what to broadcast in the meantime because they don't and they shouldn't. But after, when the renewal time came up, say, okay, here's what you promised you were going to do for the community. What have you done to complete this? And if anybody in the community thinks that's not really a good reflection of what you've done, we're going to hold a hearing in the community. They used to do that. They have never pulled a license. But it was wonderfully effective in concentrating stations on the fact that they were supposed to do something for their community. The Telecommunications Act of 1996 is emblematic of throwing that all away. They're still supposed to operate in the public interest, but it permits greater concentration. And the FCC has really reversed its position. And now the business of handing out licenses is to make as much money as possible to put into the general funds of the government instead of raising income taxes, so or not lowering them. And so, yes, I think antitrust should have been used much more actively, both as a warning that you've got to tell the public why you think public's going to be better served by this acquisition or merger. And I think the FCC needs to get back to its old standards. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do for your market?
Well, there certainly was a time when we had a stronger notion that in exchange for the use of the public airwaves, there was a public service obligation. I'm not sure that has ever been quite so strong in print media. Perhaps it has been. I guess in broadcasting, there's this notion that the spectrum is finite and that in theory, anybody could produce a newspaper if you've got the money to have the press. But I wonder whether we also in some way haven't also gotten away from the notion that generally with all media there is some sort of public service obligation. At least there once was that idea, and that, as you say, now it's simply viewed, the news is viewed as another commodity, and it's a profit-making venture, and that's what's most important.
Yeah, I think the problem, of course, with print, the First Amendment is very close to absolute, so you can print almost anything you want, and I think that's a big plus in the long run historically. I think it's a good question whether, we call corporations a person in the law, so the corporations also are covered by the First Amendment in most cases, And I think that's a problem, but that's a matter of court decisions. Broadcasters are supposed to operate in the public interest, and they can be held to it, especially in through-the-air broadcasting. Cable used to be governed by the local community government, but is no longer. And there have been permitted huge agglomerations in the cable business and in the newspaper business, in which, in the case of broadcasting, where government regulation is permitted because it's licensed, that can be implemented if the FCC and the government wishes to do it. And in printing, it takes public pressure to complain, because it's true. Anybody can print anything they want, and you're quite right. In the case of a daily paper, as long as you have a couple of billion dollars to set up a plant and so forth, and not everybody has a couple of billion dollars, so that even though you have the right to scrawl something on a piece of paper and tack it onto a lamppost, that isn't the same power as someone who has the only daily paper in the community.
As you mentioned at the beginning of the program, this issue is something that has concerned you, and you've thought about and for a long time, going back at least to the 70s, and that you thought you could get it out of your system by writing the book, and that what you found was that there was the need to continue to update the book because it didn't turn around. If anything, it intensified. Given that fact, what can be done about it?
Well, I think that there is a growing counter pressure to the problems we've been talking about. It shows up most markedly in the number of public interest non-commercial groups in Washington and elsewhere that are pushing citizen concerns about the news, whether it is the Cultural Environment Movement or the Center for Media Education or Consumer Federation of America and so forth. There are a number of public citizen by Ralph Nader's group. There is a growing consolidation of people who have a particular interest in preserving their interests in the news and in the public, general public interest. And that's a kind of lobbying pressure, of mobilizing the support of people who are unhappy with the news media, the major media as they exist today. And that's slow and difficult, but it's happening bit by bit. And I think there may be a time in the future, I don't know whether it'll be 2 years, 4 years, 10 years, when there'll be a joining together of such groups, and they will represent a very significant factor in American politics. But that is taking time. When you match that with public cynicism toward the news, which is at an all-time high, then it could result in a change within the next 5 or 10 years. But unfortunately, people are suffering in the meantime from either malnourishment, literally, or just poor information in a democracy. And I think that it requires voter pressure on the government to make the FCC, make the broadcasters toe the line, to complain to newspapers when newspapers clearly are letting advertisers and business intrude into the decisions of the news. And that means taking the initiative. And that's the difficult part. Write letters. They are not ignored. Call and fax the medium you disagree with, and they pay attention to that. They may not have a religious experience that shows up in the product the next day, but they know someone out there is unhappy and is willing to do something. And if you write a letter, let's say to a newspaper or a broadcast station, and you send a copy to the FCC, they realize that this is a small sign of something that could have political significance, that could affect their business, and I think it's useful. But it puts a greater burden on the individual citizen. That's unfair, because we're supposed to have agencies that protect that. But the response always has been, historically, when the agencies fail to do that, the citizens have to act themselves individually and in groups.
We have one more caller here. We will include Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Begdekian.
Hello.
I'm sorry. I was only able to catch a brief part of what you're saying, but yet I admire the energy with which you're telling us what to do. In the sense of direct action, and I would ask, I don't know what to ask because I've missed so much of your discussion today. But as far as, well, like public broadcasting, it seems like on PBS, it's slowly being co-opted by the conservative sponsors, the corporations responsible for advertising for mobile, for Archer Daniels Midland. What remedies do you suggest in order to bring television by the people back to the people without the censorship?
Write your senator and your members of Congress. Write to your senators and the members of Congress, or somehow communicate to them that you want more money for non-commercial broadcasting. You want to detach it from the vote of the Congress, because the best non-commercial broadcasting in the world does not get their money that way. The BBC, for example, and NHK in Japan, which have the biggest non-commercial broadcasting and the most prestigious, get their money from a fixed excise on electronic equipment, which means it doesn't come up to the Parliament every year or every 2 or 3 years, in which case the biggest companies lobby the hardest. And so I think that's one thing to write to your members of the Senate and the House and say we've got to change the financing of non-commercial broadcasting, have it more generous, and have it based on something other than a congressional vote every couple of years.
Okay. All right. What percentage of people that get their news get it from National Public Radio?
I don't have a good idea. David, maybe you have it.
I don't know that I have that number. Someone probably here would have a number they can give you. I apologize for not being able to come up with one right off the cuff. I don't imagine it's very great.
No,
compared to, you know, the commercial media.
I've seen numbers like 6, 7, 8, 10%. Mm. And I think it varies with the program, but I think it's a very influential part of the public, and I think it acts as a yardstick, so people who hear it are usually people who take the news seriously and take their politics seriously, and they're influential, and it gives them a reminder of what good news is and what good discussions are that are more than just simply a soundbite or a photo op.
We've come to the end of our time this morning, so we're going to have to leave it at that. For people who would like to read more on the subject, I would suggest you look for the book that we have mentioned. It's titled The Media Monopoly. The fifth edition came out in the spring with new preface and afterward, published by the Beacon Press by our guest Ben Begdekian. He is the Dean Emeritus of the Graduate School of Journalism at University of California, Berkeley. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.